My first question, which is always the same. Who are you and what do you do?
Well, hello. Thank you for having me on. My name is Max Temkin. I'm a designer from Chicago, Illinois, and I'm probably best known for making games. I make the game Cards Against Humanity, as well as a couple of others. And before that, I also worked in Democratic campaigns and elections. So I worked on the Obama presidential campaign in 2008, most recently the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016. And, well, I guess most recently, I just worked on the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District Commissioner race in Chicago, which I don't know if you're familiar with United States politics, but that's considered a very powerful and important office.
Yeah, it sounds sexy as well, so with the water and stuff.
It's got a good ring to it.
Yeah, catchy, very catchy, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the thing is, I finished university here. I got a political science degree. Public administration and policy analysis. That's the. It's a slightly different system, so it's not really a major. You just have to pick something. But the thing is, at the end of university, right? We have to basically. It's called a diploma here. You actually write some like a document that's 80 pages long, and you have to have like a thesis, and then you kind of disprove or prove it basically. And my thing was comparing the 2008 presidential elections in the US with the parliamentary elections in Slovenia. The online stuff. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Now, is Slovenia like basically like most European countries? Like you're going to have Labour and a conservative party?
Our
concept. I'm American, so I don't know anything about any other country.
Yeah, I know. Because it's not. No, it's. We have more parties, right? Our constitution is
right.
Kinda,
yeah, right. It's.
Yeah, it's
parliamentary stuff.
Yeah, but it's kind of modeled after the Germans, kind of. But the Germans kind of have like two large parties and then two small ones. So it's kind of a two-party system, but not really. But over here, I think it's like six or seven of them in parliament now. So it's still kind of messy over here. It's not that clear cut.
Are there like funny parties that have any seats, like the Pirate Party or?
We do have a Pirate Party, yes.
They have any seats?
No, they are not in parliament. But we're going to have an election because the last government, the prime minister quit, basically. So we have an election at the beginning of June. But our campaigning is limited to, I think it's like a month or something before the actual voting. So we don't have the, mm-hmm. I'm just going to say freak show you guys have. Like, not to be mean, but just, you know. You took it to, you know, you guys have it's a very American thing over there. So, yeah.
Yeah.
No, but the
yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're almost to blame now because of Melania. So, you know, it's kind of, we'll bear the burden there, but Trump's your guys.
Now, is there a right-wing authoritarian, movement in Slovenia? Because you do see that in a lot of European and Eastern European countries right now.
Yeah. Okay. So it's not as bad as in Hungary, because that's the one you probably have heard about, like Orban.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I've seen photos of the. I mean, they're like neo-Nazis.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna say it's not that bad over here. We have this guy here. He's been sort of the. I'm just going to, like, the bane of our political system for the last, you know, since we've been independent. Mm-hmm. And, like, the last campaign they're running now, well, they kind of started, not officially, but it's kind of modeled on Trump. You know, they had the whole, you know, Slovenia first slogans and all of that stuff. They, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the crazy part. Like, all of the crap you think you wouldn't get exported eventually just gets exported.
Wow.
So that's some of that rhetoric came back. And then we had, like, last year we had more normal people would call it like a refugee sort of situation, where people from Syria and Iraq just, you know, flooded Europe, basically. Well, I say flooded, that's what the right says. But everybody on the right called them like immigrants, but because, you know, they're not fleeing anywhere. They just want to move to Europe. That's kind of, and want to destroy European civilization, all of that stuff. So, yeah, I don't want to draw too many parallels, because I'm actually kind of wary of that. Because, like, when you say right, the Democrats in America would kind of be to the right over here, if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, at least policy-wise.
Yeah, well, that's there. It's kind of how they are here, too.
Okay, this is weird. You're asking me stuff. I'm supposed to be asking you stuff. So the reason I bring up the politics, right, is because that was the thing that kind of, when I found out about you, actually not through cards, but through Merlin, and then the awesome The Next Generation list, which I sent to everybody because I'm a big Trekkie as well.
Oh, cool. Oh, I'm so glad you liked
it. Oh, I send it to, like, I've sent that to probably about 15 people.
Now, are you primarily a Star Trek The Next Generation fan?
Well, that was my youth because it was on Croatian TV over here because I used to, like, through the summer I was in Croatia. So, yeah, TNG was the first thing.
Okay. But
then later I found
it. And was it shown in English with subtitles?
Yes. We don't do the Polish thing where it's one guy doing all the voices. Yes, we have subtitles.
Yeah, I've seen some of those Polish TV shows. They're kind of funny.
Oh, that's, yeah. No, that's actually, that's the subtitling thing. That was one of the smartest things we did over here. Like in Slovenia, and then you'll have Croatia as well. And Serbia. Basically, most of Yugoslavia will have subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, you know, people do speak then Italian or German or English because you can hear the original voices, you know. That's kind of smart because the Poles, I don't know. But yeah, I'm the original series guy now.
Okay.
Because I do a whole podcast about Star Trek over here, but that's, you know. See, you're asking me stuff again. This is weird. Anyway, the president, like the election stuff. Like why, how come you worked on the, you know, 2008 campaign?
Well, so when I was growing up in Chicago in the suburbs, it was right, you know, I started high school in 2001. So right when I started high school, you know, 9/11 happened, and that was obviously a sort of a big political moment in America. But for me, I think what really got me activated in politics was a couple years later, the Bush administration decided that for some reason we should go to war in Iraq. And, you know, I was in high school and I'd be in a civics class or a high school, you know, a social studies class. And you'd be reading about how the country is supposed to work and how international law is supposed to work and about justice and foreign policy. And then you turn on the news and you'd be like, well, it's not working that way. Like, this sucks. Like, this is, there's transparently, they're just lying to us about weapons of mass destruction and the entire geopolitical situation in Iraq. So it just really made me mad. And I just really felt like the whole world was going crazy. And, you know, I think I was also at that age where, like, you really start to just be pretty, pretty mad at the sort of systems around you. Like, I just didn't like going to school and I didn't like I didn't like the system of the school and I felt very constrained by it. So, around that time in 2003, I went to an anti-war protest in Chicago, and it was one of the first, you know, big protests that I ever went to. And I met, I saw the speakers, and I wasn't terribly impressed. I mean, I think, you know, it's like kind of like the left anywhere. Like, it's a real confused message, and people show up and they have signs for all kinds of crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was this one guy who gave a talk, and everyone sort of got quiet, and he was just really powerful and made a great moral case against the war. And afterwards I went up and introduced myself to him, and his name was Barack Obama, and he was this young state senator, and he was like, yeah, I'm gonna run for Senate in Illinois, and you know, I'd love to. I was like, how can I work for you? I want to volunteer or work on something. And he was like, well, I'm gonna run for Senate, so come volunteer on my campaign. And yeah, I've basically been working for him ever since. So I worked on the Senate campaign in 2004, and then I got an internship on the presidential campaign in 2008 during the primaries, and then I became a designer on the campaign through the general election.
That's kind of awesome. I don't know what because don't take this the wrong way, but like you can actually write, and you're kind of articulate and stuff. I'm just saying nice things to, I'll get to my point, but like the thing is, like, why never go into like journalism or media or whatever, like, because that seems like a fit for you somehow, even like independent stuff. But you know, you kind of ended up at, you know.
Yeah, so that's a good question. I certainly, there's times when I read the paper or something, you know, I read the New York Times opinion page and it's just one bad take after another. And there's certainly times where I'm like, I could do that. But I think for me, like, A couple of things. I think I don't have the discipline to be a journalist. Like, I really think that there is, you know, when I look at people I know who are really good journalists or writers, I mean, there really is a schedule and a regularity and a discipline to it of you've got to write something every day and get it down on the page. And I just don't have that. I don't know. Like, I'm not a disciplined, I'm not a good worker. I'm not a disciplined person. I never have been. I never learned those skills in life, and I just have a series of coping mechanisms, and I've built a whole career around not around being able to procrastinate and not really being good at doing work. So that's part of it. I think that also journalism has been, you know, dying ever since I was, you know, whatever, in high school. So it just never seemed like a great career move. Like, it always, you know, you just always hear about people getting laid off and publications closing. So it just never seemed like a great move for me. And then also, you know, I think another piece of it was like going back to that war in Iraq, and it just really felt like the whole world was crazy. And for the most part, I saw two things. First of all, I saw that there was the reputable journalism. So the New York Times opinion page and the Washington Post and the Chicago Tribune and all the papers and serious CNN, serious journalism, they were all supportive of the war, right? They all believed they unquestioningly reported the lies of the Bush administration that even I, as a whatever, a 15-year-old kid, transparently knew were complete bullshit. So I just didn't feel like it was very good quality. And then I felt like there were people out there who were against the war, who were writing about that, but it didn't make any difference. So then I think looking at that, I was like, well, why would I do that? Because like the people who got it right didn't make any difference. So, but I was lucky to meet Barack Obama when I did, and I felt that he was a really compelling leader, and I really believed in what he was about, and I liked, and his campaigns were well structured, and I liked being a part of them, and it was just a scenario of I got very lucky and I was in the right place at the right time.
So I agree with that, because, you know, famously the New York Times during the Iraq stuff was just that was, you know, that's gonna stay with them for a while, I think. But like what about now?
Oh no, I assure you it didn't though. Everyone already forgot. We're the only two people in the world who remember that the New York Times was very supportive. They were very hawkish, yeah. Very supportive of that bullshit war, and their yellow cake uranium, and they're blindly reporting the Bush administration press conferences, and the goddamn Colin Powell waving his metal tubes around. Oh my God, I'm mad already remembering it. But yeah, no, we're the only two people alive who remember that the New York Times was in favor of that. Now the New York Times is the liberal hero standing up to Trump.
Okay, but that's the thing I kind of wanted to talk to you about in this era, sort of the Trump era now, you know?
Yeah.
Because one of the many, I'm just going to say that, one of the many reasons I kind of like Dubai Friday is because you guys, you know, putting in mildly veer into the politics and stuff. But as somebody who's not, you know, doesn't live in the States and stuff, you know, I know what like MSNBC is. I know what CNN is. I know what Fox is. We get them over here, like an international version or the actual thing. So I kind of know that all of that stuff, right? But you guys will mention, you know, some reporters or, you know, some maybe media outlets that maybe don't kind of travel like that far across, you know, they're not like a known voice over here. And sort of, my question sort of is it, do you follow mostly like reporters? I know about the Twitter list, we can get into that, but like generally,
sure.
Do you have like a, you know, like a sort of, do you follow reporters or some smaller media outlets that do you kind of think that in the Trump era or maybe even in the Bush era would be kind of the guys that got it right now, you know? Or do you also, you know, I know Merlin watches MSNBC. I don't know how he manages that, but like, are you the same? You watch the big guys and then maybe find some smaller voices.
It's interesting because whenever I talk to someone who I look up to or I think is you know, smart or knows what they're doing, I always ask, how do you get your news? And I'm really interested in how people get their news because it seems really hard to get it right. To be honest, I don't have a good answer. That's why I always ask other people, because I'm always looking for a better way to do it. But I can tell you what I do now. I mean, the reality is I get most of my news from social media. If I'm being honest, of like how many hours a day and where do I hear about things first? I mean, I'm just on Twitter all day and I consume an enormous amount of news from Twitter. I also use the Apple News app, and this is really small and I know it sounds dumb, but it's just a small step for me, is what I try to do is when I wake up in the morning, you know, waking up in the morning in America right now is crazy if you pay attention to the news, because you're just like, oh my, you just wake up and your first thought isn't, what am I going to do today, or what's the weather like, or what, that was a crazy dream I had. You're just like, I wonder if the president tweeted anything. I wonder if we're in a war. I wonder who he fired. Oh, I wonder if there's a constitutional crisis.
Trust me, it's the same. It's like I'll speak for me. I do that as well. I'm just on a delay because of the time difference. Right. But I worry about the same stuff. So, you know.
Yeah, it's like the president gets up at, you know, 5 a.m. and he has to pee and he can't, so he's mad. So he gets on Twitter and he starts complaining about the attorney general and, you know, interfering in some court case. Anyhow, so just the small thing I'm trying to do now is when I wake up, I try to open up the Apple News app first and then I go to Twitter. And it's just, I have the Apple News app like dialed in, or at least I've tried to dial it in pretty well. And to be honest, I wish it was more customizable, but I've got, you know, where the hell is my phone? I'll just open it up and tell you what I have on the Apple News app. But I assume this is the kind of thing that you're interested in. But let's see, I have so I have Reuters and AP because they're the wires and that's just sort of the facts. And then I've got let's see what else is showing up here. Some local papers, the New York Times, CBS, Politico, that kind of a thing. And then I go on Twitter and I just read my political Twitter list and that's where I really get a lot of the nuance and there's a lot of facts that there's so much happening that it doesn't all wind up in Apple News. Like there's lots of little crumbs that fall by the wayside and I tend to pick those up from Twitter. And then another important source for me is I'm Mike Allen, who used to write the Politico Playbook newsletter, which was a very important sort of insider newsletter. He now has a new startup called Axios, AXIOS, mm-hmm. and I subscribe to the Mike Allen Axios morning newsletter. And that's a very important source of news for me. Very, very important. And finally, I mean, this is more the Mike's. It's called Mike's Top 10, by the way. His right. new newsletter, and then this is more local. But I also read the. I think most people in Illinois read Rich Miller's Capital Facts blog, and then I read Natasha Karecki's email list. And so that's my. Oh, and I do get the New York Times delivered to my house, and I just read the news, and then I try not to read the opinion page in the back. So that's kind of my morning. Yeah. That's kind of my morning routine. And you know, I'll kind of cycle through all that news until I wind up getting to work, and then I do my absolute best to like turn it off and pay attention to what I'm working on.
So how do you square that then with the 24-hour cable news networks? Because I've watched like my share of them, and it's just they're interminable, right? Like I just can't.
Yeah, they're terrible. I like how you say interminable. You sound like Zizek.
Oh, Zizek, yeah.
It's the Slovenian accent. I love it. I don't know. I mean, I don't watch them, so I don't have cable. I don't know how TV works in Europe, but in America, you have to buy a cable from a cable provider, and you get this bundle of channels, and it's a fucking mess. So I just don't do it. I just don't have cable in my house. Now, I can use an app on the Apple TV to stream CNN. I think I use – my new thing is I use the YouTube – it's called like YouTube TV or something like that, mm-hmm. and I can actually – if something is happening that's crazy, like the day that Trump fired the FBI director, I used my Apple TV to put CNN on, and I just sort of sit there staring at the TV because I don't know what else to do. You want the news, you want to feel like you're following it because it feels scary, but so I don't know. It's just a feeling of control of like you're there, you know, you're watching live as things happen, but you're right. It's horrible. I mean, I'm confident that it causes brain damage.
Yeah, I'm just gonna agree with that. I don't know what else to do there. But okay, so, one more thing about the Trump, you know, presidency or whatever it is, and then so as someone you know who kind of helped you know get Barack Obama elected, the stuff that Obama sort of wanted to do, like the glaring one, I guess, is Guantanamo, right? He didn't close it; he wanted to close it, and I always understood that as sort of you know the inertia of just the government, I don't, not just the bureaucracy, but just, you know, the whole, you know, basically aircraft carrier that is the United States government, right? You can't get everything done. But like, I always kind of assumed, apparently I was naive, that the opposite was also true, that if somebody like Trump would get into office, he'd kind of have a, like, more trouble kind of doing his stuff because it's an aircraft carrier. but it kind of feels like that's...
Trump's been remarkably... I mean, I'm actually not... Trump drives me crazy. I mean, I fucking hate the guy, but... And I spend... Of my waking hours, I spend about half of them just thinking about Donald Trump. I mean, the amount of free real estate that this guy occupies in my head is unbelievable. So, I mean, nobody hates Trump more than me and obsesses about him and thinks about him more than me. But I'll say I'm not a Trump alarmist. I actually think he's been remarkably incompetent and bad at getting his agenda done. I mean, he says the opposite, but in fact, he's passed fewer pieces of legislation and done less as the head of state than almost any president in modern history. He's one of the least effective presidents ever. And things he's managed to do are really executive orders. And what's nice about that, for me at least, is when the next guy gets in there, they can undo those executive orders.
But what about the, you know, all of the people he appoints? Like, they're going to be running those agencies and, you know, like all of the sort of entities within the government for a couple of years. Like, that's where I think the biggest damage is being done. You know, you'll see.
Well,
I don't know what I've read of the, you know, State Department with people just leaving basically because of the disarray.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's not good. It's not good. But for the most part, those departments, those are lifetime civil servants who work at most of those departments, meaning they've been there for 10 or 20 years and they're going to be there for another 10 years. And they're not loyal to Trump. I mean, they're not loyal to Obama. They're not loyal to Trump. They're just loyal to the work and the department. And I think that they've shown that they have amazing capacities to slow down and resist the worst parts of dismantling those agencies. Like, all plus the other thing is Trump is appointing these fucking idiots to these cabinet positions. I mean, these guys are not criminal masterminds. I mean, they're like pants fall down during press conferences. I mean, none of these guys can get anything done. Like, they're all obsessed with like buying expensive conference tables and security details and traveling to Disney World and stuff like that. Like, no one, like, it's just the destruction of the government is over-reported. Like, it's mostly just the same, and they've slightly changed the priorities of what those departments are working on. Mm-hmm. There's some things that are legitimately very bad. I mean, the global warming issue in particular, that really disturbs me, and I don't know. I mean, what can we do? We need a political victory, and we need leadership in this country that's willing to do our part to curb global warming. And I do think, you know, we really are close to that tipping point of it being too late to meaningfully do anything. And it does, of course, like, that's one of the worst things to me, is like, that just really keeps me up at night. It's like, I can't fucking believe that Donald Trump is president at this critical moment when we need to be doing something about global warming.
Okay, the thing you just said, that you guys need a political victory, which I assume is you need the Democrats to win, right? So just like bigger picture.
We need something, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you can be, you okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. Like just bigger picture stuff. Like, I genuinely want your opinion on this, because, you know, you have sort of what I feel like when I listen to you or read your stuff, like, you have this sort of love-hate relationship with the Democratic Party. But like,
that's very, very accurate.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But like, just looking at it very broadly, like the whole thing, like the two parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, like, how do you actually, like, what's your view of the Democrats in that whole, you know, smorgasbord? I think I'm using that word right. But like, what are the Democrats all about now by Max Temkin? Like, what would you say are the, you know, too many of them, I'm going to say it like that, or are too many of them are like sort of in that sort center with air quotes around it, but basically on the right?
Yeah, well, we don't have, this happened during the Bush administration too. I mean, this is a quirk of American politics that's very bad for the Democrats right now, which is, if you're not in power and it's not, if you don't have so the president is the leader of the party. And if you're not in power and your president isn't of your party, and it's not a presidential election cycle, and you don't have a nominee, there really is a vacuum of leadership. Like, it's very hard for the Democrats to have a message to put together. And so you have congressional leadership, but, you know, their job is sort of to build consensus, and they're working with conservative Democrats who maybe they don't support abortion, or they're mostly doing policies that cater to very wealthy people in their district. You know, or they're security state people and they want to do drone strikes and surveillance. And it's very hard, you know, unless you have a strong sort of moral leader at the center of the movement like Barack Obama, it's very hard for me to answer the question of what are the Democrats about right now. I mean, they don't like Trump, but they're also not meaningfully doing much to resist Trump, in my opinion. I mean, they're doing sort of the minimum. So I don't know. We have a leadership vacuum, and we do need a new generation of Democratic leaders. I mean, I hope that the whoever is the nominee in 2020, I hope that we haven't met them yet. Like, I hope that they're not a name. You know, like how Barack Obama, like before he was the nominee, everyone's like,
yeah, just showed up.
Yeah, who the fuck is this? Yeah. I hope that's what happens in 2020, because I don't see, personally for me, looking out at the political landscape, I don't see the person who I'm like, I would go quit my job and work for that person. Like, I haven't found them yet. Right. Now, I hope I don't regret this and, you know, whatever, in 2 years, if I do wind up going to work for the eventual nominee, and, you know, it is someone like Kamala Harris or a Cory Booker, one of these sort of centrist Dems. But, you know, so like in terms of, if you're asking me, like, what would my vision be if I was in charge and I got to tell everyone what to do? I mean, did you follow the Jeremy Corbyn election in the UK last year?
Yeah.
So I think that's very exciting. And, you know, what happened there was the Conservatives felt like Labour was really in trouble and they doubted Corbyn's leadership. And they were like, we're going to do a call an election. And we're going to finally finish off Labour, and we're going to have a Conservative government that lets us do, you know, Brexit, do whatever the hell we want. And what happened was nobody thought Corbyn could win, and it freed him of, you know, all the sort of Cameronite vampires, the David Cameron vampires. They just like weren't active in that election. Like, they thought Labour was dead, and they really got to run a leftist campaign, right? They wrote that Labour manifesto, and they said, we're going to make cheap housing available to people in London, and we're going to nationalize the rails, and we're going to have great social programs for people. And, you know, he did all those exciting rallies at soccer stadiums, and they had a great message, right? For the many, not the few. And nobody saw that election coming. I mean, I think even more than Trump, nobody saw that election coming. That's like a world historical moment of that much of an upset in an election like that. So I think it's crazy to me that in America, we're not looking at that and saying, how do we recreate what Jeremy Corbyn did? Where is the Democrat manifesto that promises people a program that will help them in their lives? I don't understand why we're not doing that. We have nothing to lose. We can't lose any. We control no branch of government. So what, guys, what is there to lose? Like, let's try something. Let's give the people a message, right? All these the policies, the Jeremy Corbyn or the Bernie Sanders, forget the guys and the politics of Bernie versus Hillary or any, just set all that aside. The actual policies of what someone like Jeremy Corbyn suggests are very, very popular in America. I mean, people are very supportive of public schools. People love lowering rent, and they love rent control. People want universal single-payer health care. It's extremely popular. It's over 50% popularity. So I don't understand why aren't we the party? People even support, they want comprehensive immigration solution. People overwhelmingly support the Dreamers. People want more Syrian refugees to be settled in America. All this stuff polls very highly. I just don't understand why the Democrats aren't the party to say, we're going to offer that to you. I'd rather, and even, listen, maybe we lose doing that, but at least we lose fighting for something we believe in. Like, wouldn't it be better to lose, to go down fighting for something you believe in than to try this boring middle of the road message that nobody likes and it doesn't appeal to anyone, and you lose with that?
You see that? Yeah. Okay. I'll just agree with that again, but I don't know how you happened. Like, how, that sounded weird, but like, I don't understand how you can sort of point to like the Labour in the UK and sort of this what I'll call like the new left movement in Europe that started in Greece. You know, we have a party that sort of follows that program over here as well. Like, I don't know how you like because if I like from my perspective, if I look at the Democrats, there's probably like three Democrats now that hold any kind of, you know, elected office that would kind of agree with you on the national level. I'll say that. Like,
right.
At least that's how it comes across. Like, how do you happen exactly?
Yeah, I mean, so that's actually not true. I mean, I'm in a big city, and so there actually is, I mean, we have a very active, you know, this organization called DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, and you know, many of my representatives here are quite leftist.
Okay.
And I think that if, you know, listen, when Obama was running, he talked about redistribution of wealth and giving everyone opportunities. I mean, it was very, if not maybe like the new left, like it was at least like FDR. It was like New Deal, right? And people came out of the woodwork. All of a sudden, Democrats were like, yeah, we believe in that. We've believed in that all along, right? And they all followed this inspirational guy. But we just don't have, I mean, it's just a lack of courage and a lack of leadership to me. I mean, yeah, I don't have a good answer for you. I mean, listen, in a lot of ways, American politics are a mirror of Europe and they're almost a few years behind. So to me, it just makes sense to pay attention to what's happening there. But like Greece is a great example. I mean, the Republicans are blowing up the deficit and spending irresponsibly right now under Trump, and as well as, so they're cutting taxes and spending like crazy. So they're reducing revenue and increasing expenses. And then you know that there's not going to be any money in a few years, and they're going to be like, we have to do austerity. We have to cut everyone's food stamps, and we have to cut everyone's housing assistance. There's no choice, right? We have to do austerity. The economy's bad. So how dumb would we be on the left not to look at what's been successful in Europe to say, well, number one, austerity doesn't work. But number two, like, it's not popular, and it's a great moment to rally the people behind a social state.
Yeah, you see, that was the first I've heard of the DSA? What's the organization? I want to write that down.
If they're called Democratic Socialists of America, okay. I mean, I'll say like they're not without problems or controversy in the United States. Like, and a lot of people on Twitter would say things like, oh, they're Bernie bros, and they didn't vote for Hillary because she was a woman. I mean, so there are critiques of this sort of new left movement. And I don't know that those critiques are wrong. I just wish we could just earnestly have a conversation about it. I wish that the Democratic Party was more capable of just earnestly having a conversation about, well, what policies do the American people want, and what can we do that will help them in their lives? That seems like the kind of question that we're not actually asking.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But you see, that kind of stuff, at least like to my eyes, even with the internet and everything, it doesn't get through over here, right? Like the news will just pick up, you know, the main stories of the day. So we'll hear about all of the Trump stuff, like the crazy stuff, right? Because that'll get national exposure in the States, right? But if somebody asked me, you know, in Chicago, I guess, you know, what the any like what the political landscape was, right, in Chicago, I have no idea. Like, you know, and that's why I kind of like Dubai Friday, because of you guys, because you're in Chicago and Merlin's in, you know, a made up place called San Francisco. But, you know, that's kind of what I like when you guys talk, when you talk about, you know, politics, because that really doesn't get like through to me somehow, you know, because the national coverage is just what I see online. And online, I mostly see like the sort of the story that went through three levels before it got to, you know, the New York Times or, you know, one of the cable networks or stuff like that. Right, so I want to kind of do an in between with the politics and the internet, because I know you're a bit an internet guy. I'm as well. I'm like one of the 10 journalists here that keep beating the drum on internet neutrality and all of that stuff. So I have this theory. We'll get to the neutrality stuff, but one thing first, because of your, you know, association with the Obama campaigns, which were famously, you know, very sort of, you know, internet savvy, let's say. Is that fair to say? Well, you know, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would say like the legacy of online organizing in national politics runs through the 2004 Howard Dean campaign, which was a campaign that was what got almost the first campaign that got me really interested in national politics. And they just had this very robust online organization. You know, to me, I was a high school student. I couldn't even vote, but I was able to sort of phone bank and participate online. They built these really cool tools. So that's where there was this company called Blue State Digital that came out of the Howard Dean campaign that legacy kind of moved to the Obama campaign. And then that also just spawned a whole sort of generation of activists and organizers coming out of that Howard Dean campaign who are still very involved in reform issues in the United States.
So see, my question is sort of like, how do you see the sort of the disparity, the chasm between, you know, people in government just not being very internet savvy at all? Like, I'm talking about the actual people in power. I know they have advisors and stuff, but like the last thing was the Zuckerberg hearings. It's just, like, to somebody that knows anything about how the internet works, that it's just painful to watch and listen to. It's just, I just die every time. Like, there's like a senator saying, how do you make money? We run ads. And it's like, it kills me every time. Like, just depresses me. Like, how do you see that? Like, has there been in the last, let's say, since the 2004 campaign, like in actual government, do you have a sense that there's more and more people that are kind of internet savvy, even in the sort of positions where you get elected, like the people actually in power? Or is it just, like you said, you know, Blue State Digital and all the consulting firms and stuff?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, on the national level, you know, in America, where do I even start with this? I think that I would point to the main issue as being the influence of money on elections in America. I mean, we're in a very dark place right now on this, and there was a recent Supreme Court decision called Citizens United that basically said that outside groups could spend unlimited amounts of money to elect politicians that they liked, and as a result, leaving aside the local levels, so like, you know, city, county, and state elections, it is very, very, very difficult and expensive to get elected to federal office, so Congress, Senate, and President. It takes millions of dollars, and because you just have to fight the other guys who have millions of dollars. I think that because of that, you tend to have real entrenchment and people get into office and then they're there for decades. And there's no term limits, except for president, there's no term limits on Congress or Senate either. So I just think you have an aging population of people who are elected to federal office. I mean, the average age is what, probably in the 50s or maybe 60s. Certainly on the Supreme Court, they're very old and they have no understanding of how technology works, which that's, if you want to talk about policy being affected by people who don't understand how technology works, boy, the Supreme Court arguments are really something. Yeah. I mean, they truly do not understand how computers work. But, I mean, this will change just like any new technology. Like, the generation that grows up with it eventually will govern. I mean, you know, when cars were new, the people who were in Congress didn't understand what the deal is with cars because they were too old. And then you had a generation that grew up with cars that grew up and, I don't know, they built highways and stuff. So it'll happen. Like, we'll get a give it 10, 20 years and you will have a generation in there who has a better understanding of how this policy, the technology works. And maybe they're able to make better policy. On the issue of net neutrality, I mean, I just think that's on us, man. I mean, our side has not done a good job connecting the values of net neutrality, the moral case for net neutrality, to the facts and the logical case. I recently went and saw a podcast on NPR called Intelligence Squared, and it's a Oxford style debate on a policy issue. So they have two people pro, two people con on net neutrality. And I felt like and our side lost. The anti-net neutrality side convinced more people to come over to their side, so they wound up winning the debate. But I felt like it mirrored the national debate, which was our side, the progressive side, they sort of dryly argued the facts of net neutrality. And then the anti-side, they were like really funny and they confused the issue and they sort of kicked mud into it. They confused everyone and they like made jokes and they were like, we don't want the government to say what websites we can read. Why should the government be involved in the internet? Right. Mm-hmm. Like it was like muddying the waters and confusing everyone, and they won. So there's an asymmetry there. I don't have an answer for this. I'm just describing the problem I see, which is there's an asymmetry in how we argue about these issues, where only one side cares about engaging in a good faith debate and the other side just wants to confuse everyone so that they can win.
Yeah, it's even I think with you guys it's at least like two sides and they're all like each is pushing their own agenda. Like over here in Europe it's even more complicated because you have like a national telecom company basically which is partly owned by the government, and they kind of mm-hmm. ruined the internet in some ways but kind of keep net neutrality alive somehow, like in other ways. But like on the European level, you have basically the Scandinavian countries which are really pro net neutrality, and then there's this group of telecoms with the German telecom being in front that just, you know, everything that can be wrong with this issue, they're basically for. So yeah, it keeps getting weirder over here, but we're safe so far with the European directive, but not for long probably.
Well, you know, here's an interesting thing. So The Facebook hearings and the Russian election meddling, it's the first time in my lifetime that I've ever really seen a national audience in America care about information data and information privacy and sort of really emotionally connect with that issue.
All right.
And someone had a really interesting, I wish I remember who said this, but someone had a really interesting take on this where they were like, you know, maybe the issue is that it's that nobody likes foreign countries owning their data. So Americans, in other words, Europeans have been very privacy conscious because it's American companies that own their data, and they feel slightly threatened by that. So they're very good and progressive on, well, as compared to the US at least, on privacy laws. Americans, it was our companies who had the data, so no one cared, right? There was no hunger for regulation or policy, or no one wanted to think about these issues until it was the Russians. And then as soon as it was like an outside, as soon as it was a foreigner, it was a, you know, oh, it's a national security issue. I don't feel safe. I don't like it. So I don't know. Maybe that's something that will inform the future of the debate, is like, you'll see more like foreign hacking and things like that.
Yeah. Here's hoping to more of that, you know, but yeah, I know. Yeah, that's a pretty good point. Yeah, I never thought about that. Like, because my default setting is I don't want the Americans to have my data, basically. That's the, yeah, I guess. We don't have that many, you know, European tech giants basically roaming around. But, you know. Just on the net neutrality stuff, how crazy it is that the FCC is basically five people? Like, how like, I don't understand. Like, just somebody that's into that issue. Can you just explain, like, how?
Yeah,
I don't even have a question here. It's just, how is it five people? I don't.
Yeah, I mean, they're not the FCC is inadequate to regulate the internet. I mean, they are a legacy. It's a vestigial regulatory body from TV and radio, and obviously now the internet is nearly every part of modern life. Like, it's everything that you do. So the idea that it's primarily regulated by this tiny body that's supposed to make rules about swear words on the radio is just wrong. And it's going to take us some time to modernize that. I mean, one interesting thing that a writer, Bruce Schneier, who's a part of the EFF, and he wrote a great book called Data and Goliath. And he has this proposal that he's like, you know, when you have a mining company, you create like toxic waste, right? And it's actually such a big deal. Like, what happens with this toxic waste and where does it go? And does it go, do we keep it forever? Is it, are there signs? Is it protected? Can it be stolen? That we actually have an entire major federal branch of government, the Department of the Interior and the, Environmental Protection Agency. We have these huge departments with thousands and thousands of people, and all their jobs are is to like deal with toxic waste and pass environmental rules and regulate this area. Well, his thing is like in the course of doing business on the internet, people create data, and that data is a lot like toxic waste. It's like radioactive waste. It's like a byproduct that's created. It has to be protected. Like, you don't want it to be stolen. And we do not have good systems in place. It's like, it would be like if people were like doing mining and creating toxic waste, but had no place to put it. Like, we don't have any system and no rules about what people do with data. You know, we have rules about the toxic exhaust that your car puts out, right? You have to go get your emissions checked and check the smog coming out of your car, but we don't have any regulation on data. So maybe that's the next thing, is that we need some sort of federal bureaucracy that manages people's data and has regulations on what these companies can do with people's data. Yeah,
that's going to go over well with about 50% of Americans when you say we need a federal bureaucracy.
No, it's too early. Now, people aren't ready for this now, but think of in the future when there's rampant identity theft and it starts to interfere if you own a business, you could get, you know, whatever, people get extorted or whatever. Like, I mean, there was a story just the other day about it was just yesterday they caught this criminal in San Francisco, the Golden State Killer.
Yeah.
And they caught him because they found a DNA match in like a consumer, in like 23andMe, like one of those consumer DNA things. But how far do we go down that road? I mean, Americans do value, they even Republicans, everyone in this country values their privacy. And And how we're going to, there will reach a tipping point where, you know, if the government does too much of that, if there's, if listen, if people are getting, if people, if they're, if your personal DNA data that you send into some startup is being used in like criminal databases without your consent, like I do think people will get pretty mad and they'll want some sort of, you know, regulatory environment to address that.
Fair enough. That's where you get to the whole, you know, the Republican side being all privacy and leave me alone, and then when that has to be enforced, there's usually the only answer is
Well, at the moment they're quite authoritarian, but I think that the libertarian movement is still pretty strong in the Republican Party.
Oh yeah, we have like 7 people over here that are libertarians, and it's hilarious to me because they have no, you know, we're different because we have our own political thing, but that's where when I said, you know, the new campaign on the right here, it kind of tries to mirror Trump's and stuff and Orban and stuff like that. Like, even, you know, that kind of what saddens me about the internet, because when I found the internet, it was the greatest thing ever, because I could get to talk to people like you and stuff, you know, not just people you agree with, but, you know, different viewpoints and stuff. But it never, like, I just, you know, that whole Adam Curtis thing, where if you look at something for long enough, it'll look back at some point.
Right.
And then you'll have, you know, the whole Gamergate people and, in Slovenia, which makes no sense. Like, we just were so far removed from everything. And you'll have, like, people that are pro-gun and libertarians and stuff. And, like, dude, you're just go to America then. I don't know.
Well, it's I felt like on the Gamergate front, it was not without its flaws, but I thought that a really interesting discussion of Gamergate, I read in Angela Nagel's book, Kill All Normies, and it's kind of an examination of contemporary internet culture, and it talks about, she writes about the sort of Tumblr leftist movement, activist movement that kind of came up online, and then how that is in sort of a symbiotic coexistence with the alt-right and the Gamergate thing, and there's many through lines and similarities. But I thought that was a really interesting read and had some really incredible stories in it, and to me it did capture this idea that young people they feel very disempowered, they feel like they have fewer opportunities in their lives than their parents had, they're less likely to own a home, they're less likely to not have debt, and they're mad, and they want a system to be mad at, and you know, different ideologies have been successful at harnessing that anger and getting young people on board with them. Like, obviously, I think it's really disturbing to see all these young people, like, gravitating towards these sort of, like, fascist rallies, but I can at a minimum, if I try to empathize, if I really am looking for a way to empathize, I can at least empathize with their feelings of disempowerment and anger at the system and feeling like they have not been given what they were promised by the American dream and by what this country was supposed to
be. Oh, yeah, you can totally look at it like that. Just, look, I'm almost at teenage angst, but it's not, it's more than that, obviously. But yeah, I totally get that, yeah. It's always just funny to me when stuff gets exported from America to, like, Slovenia, let's say, because I'm here. I'm always very skeptical of that. That's why I kind of try, like I said before, try to avoid the whole left-right thing, because it just means totally different things on some level, you know, over here or in America. It's always just funny to me. That's why the libertarians over here are just hilarious to me, but, you know. Yeah. As they are in America, probably. I don't know. But they're still strong in the,
I mean, the funniest angle to me on the libertarian thing is that they're so, like, they talk about the Enlightenment and they wave their books around and they portray themselves as these, like, intellectuals, but they're the dumbest people. I mean, their arguments make no sense and they're all sort of, you have to be pretty dumb to have, like, libertarianism be your, like, main political ideology. It's like, 'cause it's, like, not an ideology, and it's just very funny to me that they've seized on these, like, intellectual sort of memes and things like that to try and convince themselves that they're the smart ones in the debate. That's just so anyone sort of waving a book at you and telling you how smart they are is an inherently very comedic position to me.
I'll agree with that as well. Anyway, well, just okay, you mentioned Zizek, right, before, because he's probably our, you know, biggest export. That and Laibach, I think. I'm not sure you've ever heard of Laibach, probably. I don't know. But, like, they're a band, if you ever never heard of them, probably, right?
I'm looking up to see. Let's see. No, I don't think I know that.
Oh, yeah. They did this subversive thing with, like, fascism and, you know, communism. It's kind of sort of fascist iconography, but totally against it. And it was this whole movement and stuff. Anthony Johnston, I had him on my show. He's like a big fan. The guy that, you know, wrote Atomic Blonde, like the graphic novel and stuff. He was on, he's on amazing. The Incomparable.
I'm looking at they look, it seems kind of funny to me.
it's meant as a funny thing, but the music's actually kind of good if you're into that.
Yeah.
But they're like, them and then Zizek and I guess now Melania, I think, you know, probably, I don't know what else to point to, honestly.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah. So how did you, like Zizek just from the YouTube videos and stuff, or have you actually read any of his stuff?
I went to college and got a degree in philosophy, so I'm just very interested. So I went to a program that was unusual in that. In America, especially in undergraduate programs, most of the philosophy education you're going to get will focus on analytical philosophy, so logic and epistemology. But the program I did had a focus on continental philosophy. So I've just always been very interested in political philosophy and moral philosophy and post-Marxist philosophy. In particular, Zizek has always been,
He's kind of hard to avoid. Yeah.
Yeah. He's definitely out there. I think that there's some topics where I think that he's a really important thinker, and there's some topics where I think he's a little,
you can say anything like you want.
More entertainment I think anytime he's talking about capitalism and doing a sort of capitalist critique, I think he's very insightful and very smart. And there's other areas of philosophy where I haven't connected with him quite.
I just love the fact that you can say the je because it's in my name. That's his gift to me, even if he doesn't know it. Because, like most Americans, they can say Zizek somehow. I don't know how that happens, but... Because
you hear because it's in the pop culture.
Apparently. Yeah. Right. So there's one more sort of broad topic I wanted to talk to you about. Mm-hmm. It's kind of internet adjacent and stuff, but I'm going to use the fact against you now. You're the Max Tanking.
Oh, no.
So there's a question there. Will you publish my thing, right? And then you say, I don't publish. Humanity's not a publisher. Who cares? Okay. Plus, I think the publisher model stinks. Sorry. Explain that last sentence. That intrigued me because I.
Yeah. So this is only my take, right? No offense to anyone who does have a publisher or is a publisher. I mean, this is only my feelings about it. But, you know, to me, what I am interested in and why I started making games is I'm interested in independence. So that's what I'm after. Meaning I want to be able to get up and go to sleep at night and kind of own my destiny and, not have to show up to a job and not have to have anyone tell me what I can or can't do. Like, I really value that independence. You know, maybe for me, that was also part of like, you know, my whole generation, kind of lived through the financial collapse in 2008. So I saw all these people who like got so screwed, right? They had all this debt from graduating college, but then they like couldn't get jobs and you had these like this like useless like, you know, liberal arts degree and you couldn't get employment. So I just took away like, man, it just sucks to be dependent on these systems that don't really care about you and will betray you. So for me, I just like my independence and my autonomy. Again, personal value, but that's what I'm after. And I just don't feel like the publisher model is a way to achieve that. I think in order to truly have independence, you need to like make your own thing, connect with your own audience and sell your thing to your audience. And there's no room in there for a bunch of, you know, sort of blood sucking business people like publishers and distributors and platforms and all that kind of a thing.
Yeah. See that, this is sort of my shtick when I talk to you Americans, right? I love the whole concept of that, but you have the advantage of being in a market of, you know, let's just say like 300 million people or whatever. Right. And there's like 2 million of us. You know, in Slovenia.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm like very happy to support you guys that do it like Dubai Friday to kind of keep you ad free and stuff. And when I see that Patreon number, it kind of kills me. You know, I'm glad for you guys, but it kind of kills me because.
Well, you know, I'll say like, I mean, I think a lot about, you know, why don't I just leave America? Like this country is so heartbreaking and I identify, you know, and I travel in Europe, like I was in Rome, I was traveling all through Italy last summer and I was like, oh my God, like it's what a, like, that's what I just want to live in Florence. Like, can't I just go live in Florence? And it's like, they kind of have society figured out there. It's like this amazing city. Like, the quality of life is so high. Like, the food is good. Like, everyone's happy. Like, that's a good life, right? Like, what am I here, like, battling some, like, libertarian idiot over whether people should die because they can't afford, healthcare or whatever? Like, you know, like, why not just leave? But I, you know, there is that, you know, America does, I mean, to your point, like, it is kind of where it's at. Like, this is where the action's at, right? Like, this is where the culture is made. And, yeah, it's just sort of the center of the, for better or for worse, and maybe mostly for worse because of our sort of ever expanding empirical tendencies and our warlike, sort of just ever persistent, you know, bombing campaigns and sanctions and wars and everything. Like, maybe it's for the worse, but yeah, I mean, it is where the action is right now. Like, if you're in Florence, like, you're not in the mix. You're not in the middle of it.
And even in Italy, there's way more people than over here. And I'm sort of in the same boat. I do love, like, the independent stuff. That's why my podcast network is, like, I work for the national radio now in Slovenia, right? But, like, I do, after work, I do my own thing, because I just want it to be this separate thing that's kind of, you know, like, internet native and stuff. That's, it's a, like, a podcast net.
So what do you do on the radio? Are you on?
Yeah, I do a tech show with a co-host. She's Marusha Kiritz. Yeah, I do. Yeah,
that's amazing. See, I will say, I think that's very cool. That's something that is very that's a good thing about Slovenia versus America, is it is so, like, let's say that is your dream to get to be a radio host. It is so hard to be, because there's so many people, right? The competition is so fierce. It's very hard to be a radio host in America. And I do think that you have more opportunities to do cool stuff like that in a smaller country.
Well, you know, because I'll explain it to you why you're kind of right and kind of wrong. But the thing is, like, the net.
Well, I guess we probably have more radio stations because there's more people.
Exactly. And it gets even worse because over here we have, like, we sort of have the BBC model. So we have, like, the national radio and TV. That's where I am now. I'm on the second channel, which is the most listened one too. And then you have the sort of commercial radio stations that were kind of usurped by this one company that basically bought up all of the little local stations, just made this one huge net, kind of, which is kind of okay with the law, but not really, in my opinion. So you basically just have, like, there's us, the national radio, and then one more player. And that's it. And that's where kind of all of that, you know, kind of falls down, basically. But I used to write for, like, a political magazine before, and a tech I still write for a tech magazine, so I do a lot of stuff. But yeah.
Oh man, that's so interesting.
Yeah, but that sort of, that's kind of what drew me to you guys. Not just the Do by Friday, even the Card Against Humanity, and that's why I had that question about the publishing model, because the dream of mine is to maybe just do the podcasting stuff, you know, just do that full time. But that's kind of untenable if I'm just, like, doing it all on my own. I do get, like, listener support, but I can't do it at the scale you guys do it, you know?
I mean, I'm very happy with how Dubai Friday is doing. I've done a couple of projects that I'm really proud of, and I think they've done really well. But the goal of those projects, like, Dubai Friday is, like, really, to be honest, I mean, honestly, it's wildly exceeded my expectations. Like, it doesn't have to be, Dubai Friday doesn't have to be as big as it is for it to be successful, right? Like, I just wanted to have it be a small part of how I make my living. And it's doing really well, and I'm happy for that. But, like, I think people, you know, you don't have to be the biggest, right? Like, it does not take much to just support yourself independently making art that you like. And that can be, for some people, that's the dream, is not necessarily to get rich or have the biggest audience or be the biggest, but just to have that independence and do your own thing. And I wish everyone who wants that, I wish that they get the opportunity to experience that, because it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's what it kind of falls apart for me, because there's just not that many people here, you know. Because when you do it, even if you have, like, a niche audience, maybe, like, I don't, I think I'm a little bit broader, right, with my shows in Slovene. Like, it just, if you just look at the percentages, you know, people that are online, people that listen to podcasts, people that are then willing to pay for online content. If you take that from a pool of 2 million people, you know, it kind of disintegrates there at the tail end, right? You know, but, you know, I'm going to keep doing it. Like, no, I'm not going to give up, but, you know, that's why I like seeing you guys do well, basically.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm Yeah, I mean, no one is more surprised than me that some of these things have taken off.
That's why I listen to three shows where I don't miss an episode.
Oh man!
And from I think like episode 45, you guys are one of those three shows, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so what was there a tipping point? Was there
eat like the president. Eat like the president. That was, yeah.
Eat like the president. Oh, good. Okay. I still feel nauseous. Yeah.
I'm glad I get to listen to you and Alex now, because I'm actually more intimidated to ask Alex to come on my show than you. That's why I asked you first. I don't know.
Oh, she would love it. She would love it. I'm sure she would do it.
I'll send her like an email or something. Well, I that was just too much for me. I figured, because I had Madeline on, you know, Madeline be on anybody's show, but you know, that I figured you guys were the prize. But yeah. Okay. So before we get to the hardware and software, just like one more thing, because I have you for 15 more minutes and then I'll let you go. Just let me phrase it, because I have it written down in Slovenian and I have to translate in my head. So, sorry.
Tell me the Slovenian first. I just want to hear some Slovenian.
No, I can talk randomly in Slovenian. I won't ask the question if you want. But like, jaz zelo rad poslušam Dubai Friday podcast. In en od mojih treh podcastov, ki poslušam, pač ko da ne falim epizode. So I just said I'd listen to Dubai Friday and don't miss any episodes. That's
Man, I like Slovenian. It's got a good sound.
Oh, the sound's great. The language is hard as... I almost swore there, but it's hard as hell.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you, I am a big fan also of David Foster Wallace.
Hmm.
I don't know when it was. I saw... The first time I actually saw you speak was the XOXO talk when they put it on YouTube.
Okay.
And you had that expert. That,
yeah.
Like, how... I don't really have a question here, but how big of a deal is he sort of in, let's say, our generation? I was born in 83, so let's just say our generation. But
87, so same.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So how much of a big deal is he?
Well, I mean, so it's interesting. I mean, first I could tell you what I like about David Foster Wallace, and then maybe I can talk about the place that he occupies in American popular culture, because I think that's also very interesting. I like David Foster Wallace. So I first discovered him through his magazine writing. So I would see him in Harper's and The Atlantic. And I believe the first book that I ever picked up of his was Consider the Lobster, when that first came out.
Yeah.
I knew that I liked his... I take it back. I had read his cruise ship essay, maybe in Harper's or maybe online. And it just knocked me off my feet. I mean, I remember reading that and saying, and I read that maybe in college or in high school, and I remember reading it and thinking to myself, not only is this like probably the best and funniest and one of the most beautiful things I've ever read, but I will never write that well. Like, this is like virtuosic, yeah. Like, I mean, this is poetry. Like, it's just, and I also had this feeling of like, this was made just for me. This is like just made to delight me. Like, this is just so good. And then I picked up Consider the Lobster. I think that was the first book, and supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again. So that was all his nonfiction. And I really got into David Foster Wallace through the nonfiction angle, where he very pretty directly kind of talked about all this sort of stuff I was interested in: contemporary politics, philosophy, social issues. I mean, he's very funny. He's from Illinois, so there were all these sort of... There's an essay he wrote where he goes to the Illinois State Fair, and I've been to the Illinois State Fair every year of my life because I go for political campaigns, and there's all these inside jokes that I recognize from being at the fair. And I was like, oh my God, like, this is my guy. And then at some point I got into his fiction, and I think his fiction is more challenging than the nonfiction. Yeah. I will say, like, I mean, Infinite Jest, I've read it. It might be my favorite fiction book. I think it's an incredible achievement. It's a modern masterpiece. But I think, unfortunately, after he killed himself, I think, some interesting things happened. I mean, he became this sort of pop culture figure, and there was this mythology, I think, because of the fact that he killed himself, there was this pop culture mythology that built up around him of that he almost as a saint. He was almost canonized as a saint, right? Like, he was too good for this world. And that troubles me. And I think all these people watched the commencement speech that he gave, the This Is Water speech.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
A very famous speech. And so they kind of know him as an inspirational speaker, which also really bothers me, because that's not what he's about at all.
Oh, okay.
But that's most of the time they think, oh, David Foster Wallace, he's like Tim Ferriss. He gives people like inspirational,
not,
like life hacks and advice.
That's not
in the popular culture.
Okay.
In the popular culture. But they've seen that talk and they're like, oh, this is like a life hack guy or like a life coach or he's an inspirational guy.
Oh, that's so depressing. Sorry, that's just so depressing.
And then I think people know, and then I think the other thing is, unfortunately, Infinite Jest became, so many people were beating the drum of Infinite Jest, and it became this, it's kind of known as this long, smart book. It became a punchline of like, oh, have you read Infinite Jest? My favorite book is Infinite Jest, you know, and then the idea is like every guy in America has a copy of Infinite Jest on his bookshelf that he hasn't read. So it's kind of become a signal of like being an asshole that you like talk about Infinite Jest all the time and read it. And again, it's not, unfortunately, I think it's not a commentary on the book, right? It's no one is reading Infinite Jest and going, this is for assholes. The issue is just the place, the pop culture character of David Foster Wallace. And then there was that movie they made about him. You know what I'm talking about? The road trip movie with, and you know, I think that's like, I think that movie was made lovingly, but it did, it unfortunately, it sort of only focused on David Foster Wallace, the guy, and his personal story, and it didn't focus at all on the substance of what made him such a beautiful writer and his ideas. And so I don't know. I mean, I'm just frustrated with that. And unfortunately, I think it is a little bit, I think you get made fun of if you like go around and talk about David Foster Wallace now. So I just don't talk about him as much, but he's still one of my favorite authors. And I think in my writing style, I just copy from him pretty shamelessly. And you know, when I'm looking for inspiration, I just go back and read stuff and I'm like, oh, it's just something so great to me and so human about the way he writes. And I'll just probably be chasing after that for the rest of my life.
Oh, you kind of made me sad when you mentioned Tim Ferriss in the same sentence, but I get what you're saying.
Well, but he has seen, people watch YouTube. They watch that YouTube stuff and they're like, you know, it's like, oh, six life hacks from David Foster Wallace.
Oh, that's so depressing. Because I saw that, like, the This Is Water speech is awesome, right? But yeah, I love the Roger Federer thing in the New York Times. That's my favorite thing he ever wrote, like, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, I mean, that's a masterpiece.
The Roger Federer as the religious experience. That's,
yeah, I think... Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't know anything about tennis and I love his tennis writing. I think I've read at this point, I'm pretty sure I've read everything he's ever written except for The Pale King, which is the book that was released posthumously. And I've heard is pretty good. I think he got a lot of it done, before he, died. And I don't know, I'm just sort of saving it for later. I don't really know when, but I just feels wrong. It feels like if I read it, it's like, it's over. So I'm just sort of.
Yeah, you're done at that point. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm just sort of, I own it. It's on my bookshelf. I'm just sort of waiting. And, you know, someday later I'll read it.
That's kind of endearing, actually. So I think I'm using that word right. I'm never sure. Okay, so my last three questions, because then you have to go. Anyway, your hardware is, you know, your phone, your tablet, and your computer. What do you own right now, Max?
Yeah, so I have a 15-inch MacBook Pro Touch Bar, and it's I believe it's a late 2017 or 2018 model. It's very new. I finally switched over to the Touch Bar. I think it's fine. I think it is not as good as the previous generation of MacBook Pro with that, pre-USB-C, like with the HDMI port. But it's not as good as the old MacBook Pro, but it's also not as bad as everyone says. Like, it's fine. It's a good computer. Anyone who can't get their work done on this computer is too delicate. Like, come on, get over yourself. It's a great computer. So I hope Apple fixes some of the problems.
The keyboard.
I actually think the Touch Bar, the keyboard sucks. It hasn't broken for me yet, but I don't like typing on it. I think that the Touch Bar is not a good piece of technology, and I accidentally take focus out of my window that I'm typing in. Like, for example, when I'm typing something, I often like accidentally like open a new tab in the browser or like that. Yeah. Like, my hand just grazes it, and that's really annoying, and I don't know how to turn that off and stop that from happening, and I hate it. And I don't use the Touch Bar for its intended functionality. Like, it's just, I don't know, I don't want to take, I'm not trying to take my eyes off the screen, so I find it kind of obnoxious to take my eyes off the screen to use it. I think a feature that is amazing on this computer that gets overlooked a lot is the Touch ID. And I've run a little script so that in the terminal, the Touch ID does authorizes a sudo command for me in terminal. And I use that 20 times a day. And it's very handy. And I like it. And I think people forgot what a what a great feature that is. And obviously, the screen is really, 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 really good. As a designer, I only want to work on that screen. Phone, I have the iPhone 10. It's great. I have really no critique. Would I trade the larger screen size for the Face ID instead of Touch ID? Yeah, I think it's a good trade. But Face ID is not there. Not as good as Touch ID yet. Was there another question?
Oh, yeah. I always ask about the tablet or a Kindle. You know, if you...
Oh, sure. I have both. Yeah, I have both. I have the newest Kindle, the fancy
Voyage, some one of those. Yeah. Okay.
I have whatever the newest one is, and it's great. I use it all the time. My thing is at night, I usually take a bath and read on my Kindle, like kind of until I fall asleep. And the new one is waterproof, so it's great for that. And then I have an iPad Pro as well, and I travel with that. And I don't know what kind of I'm in school. I'm back in school right now. I'm in law school, and most days when I go to law school, I'll actually take the iPad Pro and the smart keyboard with me. And I prefer that for note taking. PDF. Like the main tasks I have in class are accessing PDFs and typing, and I prefer to do that on the iPad Pro to the MacBook Pro, and it's slightly less distracting to me. Like when I have the iPad Pro, when I have my MacBook, it's like I've got like Slack notifications and emails and all kinds of everything's like beeping at me, and it's very easy to like get distracted. And on the iPad Pro, like it's a little easier to just like leave it in my notes app, and you know, not feel like everyone's bothering me. And I just turn off notifications.
Yeah. All right. Okay, now five apps you actually use in your phone. You actually use, not the fancy ones, but the stuff you actually use.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I think I'm for the most part, I only have apps that I actually use. My big two are OmniFocus. I have my whole life organized in OmniFocus. I'm sure you've had other people who have covered this in more depth than I have. But I definitely recommend the David Sparks OmniFocus Field Guide. That's how I learned to use OmniFocus. It's a very powerful and excellent app. And there's a new beta out that introduces some even new, more cool functionality. So, it's a good time to be an OmniFocus user. And I also get a lot of my life is organized in Bear, in the notes application Bear. So I switched over from SimpleNote. I had a lot of sync problems and technical issues with SimpleNote, so now I'm completely in the Bear ecosystem. On Bear, I really like the idea that you can they have tags, smart tags, and nested tags, and then you can also actually embed you can do like partials. You can like embed notes in other notes, and boy, I mean, I know that sounds fiddly, but boy, like for me, like I have my whole life is organized in all these different notes, right? Like every week on Due by Friday, I just have a note and it has everything I'm going to talk about on Due by Friday. And the ability for me to quickly pull things up by tags and embed notes and stuff and have my master Due by Friday note where I can like get everything at a glance, very useful for me. And I really find it to be a great text editor, and it has all these great little features under the hood that you might not know about. Like you can like type something up and quickly and then like export it as a PDF. I don't even know if people know that, but like I use that all the time if I have to like send a document to someone. Let's see what else is on the old phone here that I use often. I am a big fan of trying to pick what's going to be useful for people. So I recommend that people use a VPN if you're in any sort of situation where you're in public. So for example, if you're on an airplane and you're connected to the Wi-Fi, or if you're in a coffee shop and you're connected to the Wi-Fi, I really recommend that people use a VPN. And the reason is it just gives an extra layer of security so that a bad actor on the network can't get your passwords or see what you're doing. There's a, I recommend, there's a website called Torrent Freak, and they kind of write news about BitTorrents. Yeah. But every year they do, are you familiar with them?
Yes.
But every, they do a great, they do a really good service where every year they have a blog post and they rank every VPN and they talk about what does it cost? What are their privacy practices? And I use the Torrent, the, every year I go on Torrent Freak and I research the VPNs and I pick the best VPN. Why are you laughing? So is this nerdy?
No, not nerdy at all. Like torrenting is still pretty big over here. And, just the fact you're the, I've had what your number 168. You're the first person to bring up Torrent Freak. Like, you are the first. So that is really why I'm laughing. It's nothing's too nerdy. It's just
so I'll tell you that I'll tell you the thing is, like, there's many, many, many VPNs on the network, thousands of them. And there's a lot of free VPNs. And what I've heard from my friends at the EFF is that many free and low-cost VPNs are actually run by state actors who want to use the VPN to capture your browsing data and your personal information. So imagine the Chinese or the Russians, and they want to, or the Americans, and they're trying to get your passwords and get into your shit. So that's why I like the Torrent Freak, is they actually do very thorough, independent, reviews of all of these VPNs, and they determine, you know, are they keeping logs? Are they run by a foreign actor or any of that? So that's just the one resource. I would say do your own research and find the VPN that works for you and use your own judgment and check out that Torrent Freak guide. I personally use a service called hide.me. And I think, at least as of my most recent understanding in 2017, 2018, I think they're pretty good and pretty private.
Okay. All right. Two more, Max.
I've recently been using an application called Airtable a lot. So this is a database application, and I'm starting to organize a lot of the information in my life into Airtable. So I have, like, for example, a list of restaurants and coffee shops in Chicago. Airtable is just it's kind of like Google Sheets, but they have a better mobile app, and it's actually truly a database and not a spreadsheet. I should have been more prepared for this.
No worries.
I have a rich buffet of interesting apps to pick from here. What else am I going to go with? I'll also throw in an app called Burner. So Burner is an app that you install, and it gives you a second phone number, and then it actually will route calls and text to that number to your phone normally. So I use this for any time I put a press release out or need to put my phone number into a form online. I don't like to put my phone number out there publicly. Yeah. So I basically on Burner, there's a little button that's like generate a new phone number, and then I use that to verify my information and everything. And then you hit burn and that phone number goes away.
Well, that has to be US only, but I will give that a try. But that has to be US only.
Oh, that's a really good point. Yeah. I've never considered whether that would work anywhere, but,
awesome feature, but Google Voice never worked over here, you know? So I just assume it's US only.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting because, like, I feel like the telecoms are more advanced in Europe in some ways, but less advanced in other ways. Like oh my god, like data and like mobile carrying was like so easy when I was in Europe, and it just worked all the time. Like, it was so cheap and easy as compared to the US. But then there's other stuff like getting, you know, these number sharing and stuff seems really complicated.
That's an accurate description. Yeah, you guys kind of, and well, we finally sort of kind of got rid of roaming in Europe, like this year.
Oh, that's good.
Not really, but it's that's way really better good. Now than it was. So I can go to Italy now and not worry about, you know, just looking at my phone and costing me 10 euros, you know. So, okay, so last question, which is always the same. If you had to pick one thing, which you might still own, you might not anymore, but that you kind of feel it was made for you. So it's a thing, like an object, not, it can be a person, like your grandmother. I always say that, don't worry about it. Anyway, what would that one thing be?
Well, if I had to pick one thing, like my house is on fire and I had to save one thing, well, I don't know. I mean, I have pretty good like cloud backup, so I don't know that I would worry about any of my computers. I definitely have some books that are very nostalgic to me. So I have, you know, books, you know, like philosophy books and stuff that I read in college that I've, you know, written all over, and they have filled with my notes and stuff. And I'm pretty fond of those, and I go back to those all the time and find good stuff in. I also have like kind of my favorite, like family heirloom. My grandfather was a POW in World War II, so he was shot down. He was a bombardier navigator on a B-24 Liberator, and he was shot down over Nazi Germany and spent a year in a POW camp. And while he was there, the Germans, it was the conditions in the camp were very bad, and the Germans would withhold Red Cross rations and give them spoiled food and things like that. And he was in charge for his barracks. He was in charge of cooking. And so they got a lot of, at one point they had a lot of these powdered eggs. So it was this powdered product, and it would clump together, and it would be terrible to mix. So he actually, using scraps of tin cans and a floorboard from the barracks, he made a egg beater with like gears in it. So you turn a little crank and there's two egg beaters and they rotate and they mixed the powdered eggs so that he could make the most of the powdered egg mix. And that's one of the only things he wound up bringing back from World War II. And, I have it in like a little case in my house, and that's probably my favorite, sort of, artifact in the house.
That's a really good answer. I just put down in my notes, his grandfather's POW egg beater. Which is a weird...
It's a pretty cool piece of design.
That's the weirdest three words I've ever put together. Like this. Max, thank you very much for doing this and taking the time. Seriously.
Thanks for having me. This was very fun. Hey, has anyone ever asked you what your five apps are?
Not for a long... Yeah, we can do this if you want.
What are your five apps? Well, hey, what are your five apps? You're not getting out of this for free. Yeah. Listen, here's what's interesting about this is you've talked to 100 some people about this. You must have the scoop.
No, Well, I use Signal for one. So any messaging now. Yep. Yeah, me and my girlfriend, I put my mom on it now with the Facebook stuff. I finally been able to convince her that Facebook is not a normal great company. So Signal is one of them. Then because I'm on Android. Yeah. I'm on Android, I should say that. I use Phoenix for Twitter, which is the one Twitter I've ever. I've used Tweetbot and Twitterific and stuff, and they're all great. But I could let Phoenix.
They're gonna. Yeah. So all that stuff's getting turned off, though, right? I thought I read that recently that they're
again?
Basically disabling functionality.
Oh, come on!
They're basically disabling functionality for all.
Like when are they gonna give up? It's like they have to give up at some point. Just let the third parties be, right? Oh, Jesus. Okay, that kind of sucks. I'm a big 1Password user. I also have the title of what's the 1Password for Families administrator now.
Oh, cool.
Because I got my folks on it and my girlfriend and her folks on it. So, yeah, there's that. And then I am a Gmail inbox user, which is because you can just snooze emails.
Boy, as Merlin said about inbox, I could not get into it. And Merlin had a great quote, which is, he's like, it feels like organizing your garbage. It feels like sorting filing your garbage.
The thing is, like, because I have my work email and then my podcast network email and then my normal Gmail, right? And then I have a bunch of emails from before. Like that, the inbox thing has been the one thing that have, in my mind, kind of works when it groups those things together, if that makes sense. Yeah. But it was like a learning curve. And then I use Todoist for my task management and life organizing. Because Todoist is it's awesome for me because the web interface is really nice. Like it's very fast. I can just open it in the browser. And, you know, it's the one thing that I love about it is the web interface, basically. The app's okay, but the web interface is awesome. And I've learned to do the natural language stuff. So, you know, I have to write it in English. That's also one of my shticks. If you ever listen to Clockwise, I'm the guy just complaining that
the Todoist. I think we did a Todoist challenge on Due by Friday at one point, and it drove us all crazy. But I'll I'll have to follow up on that.
Oh yeah, and then I'll do one more because I need to Pocket Cast because I have an iPad.
Oh, okay.
And Pocket Cast is the one podcast app that syncs across everything, and they have a web interface which I use a lot. And that's how I can listen to Due by Friday.
Now, why aren't you why aren't you an iPhone guy? It just seems like given your...
I should be, yeah. And ATP is the second...
Just seems like...
ATP is the second podcast I listen to all of it. So, okay, so my dad was a designer, right? So he had a bunch of Macs, like the G3s and stuff, like way back when. But the Mac over here was until very recently, or maybe like in the last 10 years, maybe it became something that you could actually like afford and not just, you know, just go into debt by owning the thing. And Apple, as great as it is, I think the first year we actually got the iPhone directly from Dan through the carriers, was, I think, like 3 or 4 years ago. Before then, you basically had to buy it unlocked in Italy or Austria. And it was like, I think, I don't know, it was like 800, like 700, 800 euros. And just like for a comparison, I think the average wage over here is like around 1,000 euros. So you kind of see that that doesn't really square. It wasn't a $200 phone when you, even when you signed a 2-year contract, it wasn't like a $200 phone. So it kind of, that yeah. was at the beginning, because I'm a tech guy, because I've been writing about tech for like 10 years. And I do everything in Gmail, and Gmail and Android are kind of great if you use a phone that has stock Android. And
there's no. I mean, that is a frustration for me. Is I'm on the Google ecosystem in terms of Google Calendar, yes. and Google and Gmail. I use consumer Google Calendar and Gmail, and they're phenomenal.
Yep.
I'm a little worried that they're going to fuck up Gmail with this new update, yeah. but. It is very hard to get it working seamlessly on the iPhone,
exactly.
and I've always struggled with that.
But I am on iOS with the iPad, so you know I'm not. And I sort of do it. Even I've convinced myself for work to kind of be in, you know, have a foot in every OS, so I know what's going on. And I do love my iPad. I do kind of. I've been using it less and less because the phones have been getting bigger, but I still do use it. So, you know, but I this is the first year, because when the Pixels came out, you know, the Google Pixel phones, they're not available over here at all, basically. Like, you can buy them in, I think, Germany and the UK and maybe France and maybe Italy, but I'm not sure. But you can get them in Slovenia. You can, but they're just, the markups are insane. So this has been the first year where I've been actually considering getting an iPhone. So we'll see how that goes, but, you know.
Boy, I love that. I love that iPhone X, like, or the 10 or whatever we're supposed to call it. Like, one thing I really like, we were just talking about this in Dubai Friday, but one thing I really like is, like, the screen. It's the first iPhone screen I've owned where the screen is big enough that I could actually use the Kindle app and read a book on there in a pinch. Yeah. And it doesn't feel ridiculous. Yeah. Like, it's just enough that it's okay to read. And I love that, because if I'm on the train or in a waiting room or something, like, you know, that's what I want, is like, you know, maybe I don't have my Kindle with me, but I want to be able to jump into it.
Yeah, I had that with the phone before this one. It was the Nexus 6P. It's like a Huawei phone, but it was the Google, like a Nexus, so it had stock Android. And that was like a 6-inch phone, mm-hmm. but it was kind of thin. And that's where it kind of changed for me, because I'd usually just reach for my iPad for all that stuff, but then like the Kindle app, and I read the New Yorker a lot, so I'd found myself reading stuff on the phone, which never happened before when it was all like, you know, around 5 inches or whatever, the screens are four and a half. So yeah, that it's changed a lot in the last couple of years. So So yeah, I should be an iPhone guy, but I'm still kind of holding out. I'm recording this on a Windows PC. If you want to get,
yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah. I still use my Mac for everything, but I'm recently back in the Windows ecosystem just because I built a gaming PC. So that like PC games are just so good right now. Yeah. So
same here.
Yeah, I just felt like I was missing out.
And, yeah, because Apple just does not care.
Yeah,
the bot game.
No, just, it's not. It's not. It's just simply not feasible. But mostly it reminds me of how bad Windows is. Like, Windows just sucks. It's just hard to use.
I know
where anything is, and it's poorly designed, and it looks like shit. Like, it's just bad.
But like, Windows 10 looks, passable. Can we say, like, if it's on a scale from 1 to 10, it's like a 5.1. Like, just visually, or no? Or am I being too kind? I'm like grasping at straws here, but like,
what, Windows?
10, like Windows 10.
Windows 10 is better than it's been in a long time. Yeah. Like, it really hit a low. For me, after Windows 95, there was a dark period of Windows design, and you know, Windows 2000 whatever.
Yeah.
And it never recovered. And I think Windows 10 is starting to modernize, but I don't know. It's like too helpful in all the wrong ways. Like, it has like too many features designed to help you and make things easy, but they're always getting in the way. Like, I don't know. I can't ever make heads or tails of it.
Genuinely, thanks for doing this, because this is like,
this was very fun. A pleasure to talk with you. And let me know when you want to get Alex on, and I'll make the
intro. Awesome.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, pleasure talking with you. Bye.
Bye.